eczema's unrelenting itch and rash. If you know the feeling, you should know the facts. The eczema medication you're taking may not be right for you. Visit MyRawTruth.com and talk to your dermatologist about your symptoms and treatment options.
This is Sarah Spain from Good Game with Sarah Spain, brought to you in part by Vital Farms. Let me tell you why Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are the only eggs I have in my fridge. The hens. They're living the good life. Fresh air, sunshine, and wide-open pastures. I use my Vital Farms for my famous frittatas. And you could trace your eggs back to the farm they came from. Check the carton for the farm name, pop it into VitalFarms.com/farm, and boom, you're looking at the pasture. So next time you're in the store, look for the black carton in the egg aisle and visit vitalfarms.com to learn more. Vital Farms, good eggs, no shortcuts.
Today on The Grave Talks, part two of our conversation about telepathic tales with author Daniel Bork. You kind of just touched on something too about knowing, like, where the hunter knows where the animal is. And there's a chapter in the book that's Treasure, Tombs, and Visionary Boons. And it's all about people knowing, and it, once again, it could come in different forms, come through a dream. And we've heard the stories before about even like a psychic. There's a missing person, and the psychic sees this vision of this person, and they have found people this way. Or it could be like the example I gave about the person seeing the paperwork they were looking for on the mantle. It could be, you know, you're trying to find the will of someone. And in a dream, it's like the will is here. And they look there, and sure enough, there it is. I find that so interesting, too. That's, and once again, those stories that you've collected across time, across cultures, across generations, this has happened everywhere throughout time.
Absolutely.
I find that so interesting.
I absolutely, I do too. I'm kind of addicted to the whole concept of it, really. Just the similarities just can't help but kind of, they kind of beg attention. And like you're speaking about the chapter on Treasure, Tombs, and Visionary Boons. Mm-hmm. That was a chapter I really did enjoy writing. You know, some of the most famous stories from antiquity have, you know, apparitions guiding people to, you know, treasure that's hidden in walls or under floorboards, for example. And you'll find the same in ancient Chinese tales, for example, like an 8th century emperor who dreams that an old man appears to him and tells him that a huge white boulder has fallen to earth in a specific mountain range, and that he should go and look for something there, like, and then he finds it. And this is something I want to get across to people also, is that, like, yes, a lot of dreams are acted on and they don't come true. Yes, dreams can be spurious. Yes, faulty belief systems can come about based on dreams. But I wanted to be made very clear that, in some, contrary to a lot of the early ethnological works, suggestions of these so-called primitive peoples, you know, many of these dreams and many of these beliefs, you know, even social statuses, were based not on just any dreams, but veridical dreams, dreams that actually did specifically turn out accurate. Now, what this is, whether or not you believe the dream, whether or not you believe that was a coincidence, the fact is the dream did correlate with the external world. Those are the kinds of experiences I'm interested in. And those are the kinds of experiences that many ancient beliefs are actually predicated upon, rather than some sort of vague, unreasonable belief that dreams may tell truth. Just to go back to the chapter again, like, so to be clear, you can find so many accounts, whether it's in ancient Greece, you'll find an ancient Athenian being guided to the location of a bronze urn, for example, by a god. Or you'll find, but in a 20th century collection of dreams, you'll find a peasant in France, for example, and that's their words, taken in a dream by a mysterious young man to the base of an old wall. The man then points to a large stone and recommends that he raises it up, under which he finds treasure. Okay. So you can say, from in ancient China, you have these kind of external entities, whatever they may be, ultimately, you know, telling you the location of something lost. But then you have it in 20th century France, but then also you have it in like Irish collections of Irish and Korean folklore, for example, like in Korea, and then in, for example, Lewis Jones, in a collection of New York folklore from the 40s, found that even still today, ghosts very much, quote unquote, tell or try to tell where money is buried, even noting that the buried treasure lore required, quote unquote, special notice for its ubiquity among New Yorkers, Sicilians, and Italians. So again, I come back to this point that in whether it's in the 40s New York, whether it's in it, you know, Italy, whether it's in the folklore collections of, you know, the of Irish folklore collections or Finnish folklore collections, ultimately, we don't need to use the cultural dressing to even describe what's occurring. Something external is giving information to specific individuals regarding it, something in the external world, which actually turns out to be true. And that is the important point. And that's why the accounts persist through time, in my opinion. Let me be clear also, like, to be fair, like, it certainly will be the case that some of these experiences will be explicable through some sort of faulty memory, some sort of glitch in memory, for example. The problem is that people are very quick to immediately suggest this to be the case for all examples before actually looking at them. And that, of course, in and of itself generally comes from a kind of a, you know, philosophically materialist worldview, which is fine. You're entitled to your worldview. I just think that we should be more open-minded in areas where we have so little data collected. That's just an objective fact that we have little data collected in these areas, especially as it regards to memory in relation to these kinds of experiences. But in terms of these lost items, like, again, we can speak to that contrast between cultural reactions. Again, like a Native American Indian, for example, would not necessarily find it surprising. And it's not to say that some won't at some times, but generally speaking, it wouldn't be inherently surprising that some sort of external entity, whether it be some sort of, you know, deceased ancestor, or maybe another spirit, a forest spirit, even a spirit of a rock, for example, among certain tribes who believed in animism, that would give information about something in the external world that turned out to be true. We can see the contrast. For example, psychologist Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer, she has passed up now, but she wrote an amazing book called Extraordinary Knowing, I'd recommend to anyone. And it deals with her kind of travels through these realms of, you know, anomalous cognition. And it was based on one of these experiences from this chapter. The entirety of her research was kind of predicated upon the experience of when her daughter lost a harp. They pretty much, you know, it was important to her, and they kind of used up every avenue in trying to locate it, and it couldn't be found. And as Mayer explains it, as a kind of a joke, her friend, it wasn't a joke to her friend, but Mayer's friend suggested that she ask, I believe, a dowser. And Mayer didn't believe in anything of the sort. But as it turns out, and as Mayer will explain in the work, the dowser did accurately divine the location of this missing harp. And that experience, of course, while it's not necessarily surprising in one culture, it can literally engender a work as extraordinary as, if you'll excuse the pun, Extraordinary Knowing. So that speaks again to the kind of cultural differences between these accounts. And I think that it doesn't undermine, I don't think that undermines, you know, awe. I just think it means that awe itself is the thing that we should be kind of, how should I say it? I think awe itself is just something, you know, beautiful to be valued, whether or not context defines if you experience it.
When you were researching the book, even before you got started and you were putting together kind of an outline for the book, were you kind of surprised by the direction the book ended up taking? Were there things that you encountered that you weren't quite expecting, or some surprises in your research?
It's interesting because I would say that despite the fact that I did expect to find many of these accounts, I can't say I wasn't surprised by how many I found. I have to say that. Like, and such that, again, you know, it will take up another book at this point. I'd say something surprising. Okay, I would say perhaps the most surprising thing about this work, this is said in the least self-aggrandizing way as possible, is that it hasn't been done. Okay, that really surprised me. I was surprised to find how little cross-cultural historical work has been done in a comparative sense regarding extrasensory experiences. I think that that is something that is definitely opening up at the moment, not to any kind of vast or, you know, game-changing degree, but I think that it's something that is a kind of a open avenue of inquiry that I hope people will kind of travel down more frequently, especially, you know, not especially, but certainly historians of religion, who deal with anomalous experiences, for example, in the lives of the saints, etc.
And you know, there are people listening to this right now who are like, I get that. I've had that happen to me before. Other people are like, I have never had anything like that happen to me. So I find it interesting how some people can live their whole life and not have an experience like that, while where other people might have one really profound one or multiple experiences. And I don't know, like, what the similarities, like how it would happen to one person and not another. Sometimes it seems like reading the book, some of them just seem like that was a random thing. Other cultures, you know, maybe they're smoking something. And I mean that with all respect.
Absolutely.
And maybe things like that could bring on these experiences too, you think?
Oh, they absolutely do. In the West at the moment, a lot of these experiences do kind of come upon us spontaneously. Among so many indigenous cultures separated by oceans, separated by, you know, time, you know, they do actively seek these experiences, and they do actively seek the kinds of knowledge that I'm speaking to in these chapters. Like, there are many accounts in the book wherein, for example, the shaman will enter an altered state of consciousness using, whether it's a brew, whether it's a snuff, whether it's a, you know, some sort of drumming or dancing into trance. They specifically enter these states in order to attain this information, whether it's that someone is coming, whether it's that someone is going to arrive in the village soon. One can only imagine how important, you know, such things were in those days when, you know, languages were different. You could have 50 different languages, you know, within hundreds of square miles. And that also they would enter these states in order to locate missing persons, for example, or in order to kind of, again, attain the location of lost items. So what we're seeing is that in the modern accounts, people are spontaneously attaining the same information that those shamans, those medicine men, those specialists purposely sought out. Like, they understood that it was something that could be done. Yeah, it's interesting to see how that travels through time. And I want to be clear again, it's not that all accounts in the West are spontaneous, and it's not that all accounts outside the West are sought, but it seems to be respectively the majority in each case. And why some and not others? I think it's all of the above. I really do. I think that's, for example, some people do have these experiences, but they forget them. You know, we have evidence of this in near-death literature, where a child will speak of an experience that they had during their period of near-death, okay? But then later they can entirely forget having spoken about it, for example. And as you mentioned with deja vu, like, some cases of deja vu could be explained by a dream that actually did occur. But of course, by definition, you have forgotten that dream.
Right.
So yeah, it's all of the above. You know, we can talk about fate. We could say maybe some people are supposed to have these experiences at specific times for specific reasons. And then we could easily say that if somebody says, well, why not me? You know, why this person, or why is this person special? Maybe your point is not to have that experience also for a very specific reason. Maybe you wouldn't reap the same benefits, et cetera, et cetera. Who knows? So I do think it's all of the above in that case.
Have you ever had a telepathic experience yourself?
I would say I've had, well, I'm a twin for starters.
Oh, that's a whole different thing.
So that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, when I was, I've had so many experiences, let me put it this way. I've had so many experiences which are entirely indistinguishable from those extrasensory experiences, which I do believe in many cases were legitimate extrasensory experiences. There are so many of those, I honestly don't even know where to begin, but it could be something as simple as, like, I've just told my twin many times specifically what they're thinking of, and it turned out to be accurate, for example. Or, you know, I remember growing up, there are so many examples where my brother and I would mention something that our mother hadn't bought for a long time, for example, and she would be out at the time, and she would bring that exact item home that day, for example. That was something that would happen extremely often. Or like, but then I can kind of get more to the more kind of serious experiences too that run through the family as well, which are like the crisis apparitions. Those have been in my family too. Like my brother, for example, he told us that he had seen a particular individual walking his dog on a particular day. However, we had to inform him, because he didn't know, that that person had actually died earlier in that same day. So that was an experience that he had growing up. And that's something that many members of my family have had, which goes back again to the first book, these crisis apparitions. They're kind of exceptional experiences which are surprisingly common, in which individuals learn of the distant death of another through an unordinary means. And yeah, that's also something that I haven't personally experienced, but many in my family have.
And that is touched on in this book as well. Yeah. Obviously, the first book, that's all that is about. But I do find it interesting how people will have those experiences. I recently interviewed someone on another episode of the Grave Talks where he saw a friend of his at a stoplight next to him in the car. So he was actually able to look at him and see him. And he's like, what is he doing here? Because he sometimes went to that city for work. And he's like, and he didn't call me. And he was mad. It's like, there's my friend and I'm mad he didn't call me. Wow. Should have called me. Got home, his sister called, and that person had passed away. So he,
wow,
it's not possible he saw that person. But then it was so, he was so sure it was him, he was mad at him, you know?
Yeah, this is the thing. This speaks to so many interesting points, because it's funny you mentioned that exact type of account, because I have a chapter in the book called Revenants, Wraiths, and Disinterested Shades. Okay, so that's like a perfect example of a disinterested shade. A shade being kind of a term in antiquity for one of these kind of wraiths or ghosts. Like, it's interesting that, you know, because a lot of people often suggest that, you know, experiences with ghosts are mediated by the individual's kind of will, their wants, their wishes, their desires. In these cases, of course, however, there is no expectation of death. As you mentioned, your friend thought that the person they were viewing was actually alive at the time.
Okay? Right.
So it's interesting in that context alone that they're acting disinterested in the observer. Mm-hmm. You would think that if you were having some sort of hallucinatory fantasy about your wants, wishes, and desires, that the externalized being would actually want to interact with you. But this is something that does come out in the tales as well. Like, you will find accounts in Guatemala, for example, where the wife will see the husband working away in the fields, just doing his ordinary work, and yet discover that he had actually been dead for however many hours before. There's no special interaction between the experiencer and the object of the experience. And I think that quote-unquote mundanity actually speaks to the mystery of these experiences even more deeply, which I find fascinating. Again, it comes down to kind of beliefs and cultural predispositions, because your friend, of course, would have been surprised in that case. And this kind of brings me to something else, which is a phenomenon called deja visite, okay? So this is the phenomenon of dreaming of a place before having come to that place. It's going to be a chapter in the next book.
Mm.
And the reason I bring it up is because due to the extent to which kind of so many cultures beyond the West, and I will say beyond the West, mostly speaking to the academic and secular West, believed in a soul, and they believed that during sleep the soul left the body, and they believed very specifically in certain cases that the soul would travel to places and visit places that you yourself have never been. So the point I'm making is that therefore when you have the experience of, oh, I've been here before, in that culture there is no surprise, because that can easily be explained by the wanderings of the soul. Oh, this is actually where the soul was before. That makes complete sense. But for us, of course, you know, it's much more mysterious. And just the same with the case that your friend went through, you know, there isn't this, again, I will say this, there isn't this easy kind of framework within which to fit it. And I think that can be unfortunate, because it does kind of hinder assimilation of these experiences. But it's just where we're at the moment. And I think that just talking about them kind of can help.
So with the next book, Telepathic Tales Part 2, will you organize them, and have you come across some other ways to group these stories, or is it kind of just sharing more stories within the same kind of chapters that you have in the current book?
It would be very similar, but I do think more, how should I say this? Well, I'm not sure how wise it is to undersell the book I'm trying to promote right now, but I think it's a little bit more refined, maybe. We'll say that. And I think that the approach is the same, basically. But I do try to make a bit, I do try to connect, make kind of connections between the counts a little bit smoother, we'll say, but maybe a little bit more detail in between the accounts. But in general, yes, I take the same approach. I just happen to be dealing with entirely new experiences.
I found it's a fascinating read, because it goes back to your other book too, also a fascinating read, because I found crisis apparitions. I didn't realize how common that was. Mm-hmm. And then the same with this book. You've heard of it, you know, we're all kind of, you know, products of our own environments. And so we don't always think that, oh, in Roman times or in, you know, Greek mythology, perhaps, or indigenous people here in the U.S., it could be somebody in Vietnam, all over the world throughout history, people have had these experiences. And it's interesting to me that nobody has yet to be able to put their finger on it going, this is why, this is how that happens. And I don't know that that will ever happen, that anybody could ever scientifically say this is how and why. But it's interesting that it occurs.
Absolutely. And we can appreciate it from that perspective, from the kind of social science perspective, like as a phenomenon which influences belief and behavior, and it's worthy of investigation in and of itself for that reason. That's for sure. And even in that sense, though, these things have been overlooked. But of course, I'm glad you actually made the distinction between, because there are ways. Okay, so basically, like, for me, I do think it could be possible to draw reasonably solid conclusions from this kind of data using, you know, abductive reasoning regarding the preponderance of evidence. Like, for example, there are things that we will never be able to do in a lab, yet we still take as for granted and a given, such as the halo of dark matter that expands around a galaxy, or the first 5 seconds after the Big Bang. You know, we speak of these things very definitively. The reason for that is that we don't only use experimental science in order to determine whether or not something is quote unquote true, or at the very least reasonably believable. We can use the preponderance of evidence. And I just want to make that clear, because it's something that is often missed, because people will again discount an anecdote because it isn't repeatable. The problem with that is that many things in cosmology, for example, or in psychology, are also not repeatable, and yet we take them at face value.
Right.
So the real issue is that it's not that you have a problem with the anecdote being unrepeatable, it's that you actually have a problem with the anecdote itself, what it may suggest, and the philosophical worldview it may entail in order to kind of take it at face value. So it really does come back more deeply to the individual's composition and kind of predispositions, and how that mediates their interactions with these experiences.
For anybody who thinks that's not really a thing, read this book. It's so interesting, example after example after example. And so once again, you put together all of that, all of those stories. And some of it could be folklore, some of it could be legend, but you put it all together and there is a through line that's there.
Mm.
And so I find it fascinating.
For me, it's always been, again, as I opened the interview with, like, it is the sheer volume. Mm-hmm. If the sheer volume of accounts, I believe that if a large enough volume of accounts from, and so many of these accounts are collected from Western academics, I want to make that clear, ethnological and anthropological records, historical records. Okay, so in many cases, it's not just, I'm not appealing to authority, I just want people to know that the sources can be considered reasonably reliable in so many cases. If a vast majority of those accounts, a vast number of those accounts, I should say, separated by across by cultures, by times, by oceans, by belief systems, happen to be telling the same story, not just generally, but highly specifically and idiosyncratically, in really specific ways, such as interactions with the dead, for example, or external messengers, for example, etc. I think that if your curiosity is not piqued, then there's something... I'm not sure if the intellectual approach is adequate. That's all I'll say.
Well, I would highly recommend people read the book. Where's the best way for people to get it? Is it pretty much sold wherever books are sold?
It's pretty much sold wherever books are sold. Awesome. You can get it on Amazon.com and from my publisher, Inner Traditions.
And then you'll come back again because you've got part two coming out. And then do you have another book in the works as well?
Yeah, I actually have. So I have a book coming out in January with the same publisher, which is called Deja Reve and Love at Second Sight, The Experience of Meeting in a Dream Before Meeting in Life. So that book deals solely with that experience we mentioned earlier.
That'll be interesting.
That's coming out in January. And but Telepathic Tales 2 itself hasn't been submitted yet. It's just a project that I'm working on. In fact, my publisher will probably be discovering its existence if they hear this interview. So there you are, guys. But we'll see if it goes through or not. And yeah, I'll be happy to speak to you about both books in the future.
I would love that. Thank you once again for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, appreciate it.
And that wraps up our conversation with Daniel Bork about his new book, Telepathic Tales, Precognition and Clairvoyance in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. You can find the book wherever books are sold. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, then you can become a Gravekeeper. You can sign up on Apple Podcasts and try it for 3 days free. You could also go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you very much for listening.